This is Audible.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Infinite Monkey Cage, recorded live at the Glastonbury Festival! They're ready, Brian! This is a festival that is ready for inertial frame of references! This is a festival that's ready for gravitational waves and how we detect them, but no time now. So, first of all, Brian, we start off. Why are we here?
It began with an exponential expansion of space-time called inflation and the inflaton field decay.
Right, so why are we at Glastonbury?
Well, we're at Glastonbury because we are going to consider the sound of music.
Right. I should make it clear we're going to consider the sound of music, not the sound of music. Which is a pity. I know he loves it. I tell you what, if you've never seen Brian in a Wimple singing How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria, you haven't lived.
I was told it was actually about the sound of music.
No, it is about the sound. We can do the science of the sound of music. What is music? What is the sound of music from an acoustic engineering and evolutionary perspective? And we have put together a supergroup of brilliant minds. So, on guitar, voice, and sudden moments of visual clarity, Katie Tunstall. On poison dart frogs and sloths, it's Lucy Cook.
Acoustic engineering and constructing musical instruments and courgettes, it's Trevor Cox.
On carefully honed routines about Scientology and so also on the cusp of frequent legal actions, it's Matt Kirshen.
On jazz, electronica and the work of Paul McCartney, Brian Eno and Cirque du Soleil, it's Nitin Sawhney.
And this is our panel! Trevor, we'll start with you as an acoustic engineer. We always like to have definitions. So first of all, what is music?
Well, it depends what perspective you want to take, but from an evolutionary point of view, you know, we get a lot of pleasure from it, but it's a bit of a mystery why we have evolved to like music. So some people argue, like Pinker, that it's auditory cheesecake. We have the sort of mechanisms in our brain to enjoy music really for speech, because when you say a vowel, it's a bit like singing, isn't it? It's a sing-song kind of sound. And so it's kind of almost an accident that we have music, and we love having it, and therefore we just kind of exploit it. So one perspective, it's not really got any evolutionary purpose, but it's just something we do. The other perspective is it's crucial to things. And, for example, when you get a mother teaching a baby to speak, they use mother reads. So one argument is actually that music predated speech, and it's how we learn language. And actually, if you go back to Neanderthals, their first sort of proto-language, or our ancestors' first proto-language, might well have been sung rather than spoken.
So I'd heard that in terms of the Neanderthal brain, there's a sense that music comes in about 40,000 years ago with Homo sapiens, but there is also some evidence to suggest that Neanderthals as well?
Well, I wouldn't say there's... I mean, the evidence we have for when we'd had music is actually old musical instruments. You find vulture bones which have actually got holes and make flutes, so that's about 40,000 years ago. But music probably existed before. It's just there's no archaeological evidence for it earlier on. So I suppose you could take a guess that when we became big-brained, which is a long time ago, and that predates the Neanderthals, that maybe we were starting to sing then. But the evidence is really sketchy, so it's very hard to be sure.
Does that mean that you might think that anything that's sufficiently intelligent anywhere in the universe or even on Earth, any species that's sufficiently intelligent would have music because it's a part of the way anything communicates, essentially?
I suppose it depends what you think music is. So we might think of birdsong as being music, but we might just think of that as a way of them calling it just a communication system. So one of the things which separates music, I guess, from birdsong is that humans are pretty unique in actually just doing it for fun. You know, we'll sit and put some music on just for our enjoyment when we're not trying to attract mates or we're not trying to protect territory. You know, we use music not for evolutionary purpose.
So Nitin, can I just ask you, how do you balance out when you're just professionally playing music and when you're playing music to attract mates? Do you find there's a specific division?
No, I don't know how to answer that, actually. I think when I'm making music, I'm always thinking, just to get back to what he was saying, in terms of sound and music, I think of them as quite separate because, for me, sound inspires music. And I'm always looking at music as it's a human thing for me, because it's you've got to have the intent to make music. So if you're listening to birdsong, for example, like a nightingale or whatever, which is something strangely I did recently, you can actually write music that's inspired by that, and you have to intend to do that. Whereas the nightingale, obviously, well, from my perspective, wouldn't be intending for its sounds to be musical. It would just be using them to attract a mate, as you were saying. So it's kind of, the difference is that I will be interpreting what I'm hearing into music and changing it that way.
So Lucy, in the, you look at animals, like a nightingale, birdsong. Mm. So is it absolutely known that it is purely an evolutionary thing? It's mechanistic. Or is there any sense in which we can say that these animals are, there's more.
That they're enjoying it, yeah. I mean, it would be lovely, wouldn't it? It would be lovely to think that there were other animals out there that enjoy music in the way we do. And birds do release opiates in their brain when they are singing. So they are getting some pleasure from it, you know, just as we do get pleasure by dopamine being released. So that's the drugs in the sex and drugs and rock and roll. Birds have that too. But in all likelihood, it is a sort of it has a functional role in the animal kingdom. We haven't really been able to find an animal which is just enjoying music for music's sake.
So would you agree then that the music in humans probably started with some kind of functional role?
Yeah.
As you say, maybe the origins of language or in Neanderthals.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, the idea that it's a pleasurable thing is superimposed on top, essentially.
It would seem so, yeah. I mean, definitely there's ideas that it's a fantastic way of conveying emotions, music, you know. So it might have been an early way for humans to convey emotions to large groups of other humans that rally us and make us defeat the Neanderthals, for instance. It may have been the fact that we had music that gave us that ability. So, I mean, they've, in terms of conveying emotions, they've just recently found that there's a group of gorillas that actually hum while they're eating, and they make these humming sounds. I don't know whether that's a particularly good impersonation of a gorilla humming whilst eating its dinner, but anyway, that is the impression that you've got. And that's conveying an emotion. They think that's because it's sort of saying, this is, it's okay to eat now, I'm eating, I'm enjoying this, and then the sort of song there is, so it could well be that that was a part of
that's weird, isn't it? Because in gorillas, we see that as a sign of intelligence. But if you sit opposite someone who's humming while they're eating, you don't go, what a clever man. Chewy.
Katie, this idea that music is primal in the sense that it almost suggesting it predates intelligence. I mean, does that fit in with your view of it, that it's an extremely primal thing?
Well, I mean, my experience, I'm sure Nitin would say the same, and you would say the same as well, that being a musician is quite an undertaking, and it's quite unlikely it's going to happen. So there's a lot of risk involved in doing that. And I think that a lot of the reason for chasing that is that there is definitely an innate compulsion to make music as a musician. And you really suffer if you don't make it. It's quite a physical experience of an unpleasant feeling if you're stifled from doing that. But I think from what Lucy was saying as well, that you can imagine that it was probably more likely that music was a very necessary part of life tens of thousands of years ago, where it was a ritualistic thing, it was a spiritual thing, and that obviously still exists in our culture today, that it's used in that way. I mean, here is possibly my favourite gig in the world, playing at Glastonbury, and it's just that amazing feeling that, and it's why everybody comes, is because you can't really get that sensation unless you're with a group of people who are there for the same reason, watching the same thing and having a very communal experience. And I guess sport is quite similar, but there's something very emotional and heart-opening about this environment and watching music in that way.
Matt, you have been returning to Glastonbury. You're not a musician, you're a comedian. What do you think, from a biological perspective, draws you back to the Glastonbury Festival, to this huge music festival every year?
Well, I don't know. From a biological perspective, there is that idea that maybe Glastonbury is recreating evolution's initial conditions. So it's quite exciting for me. Like, we might actually be like somewhere in the middle of this primordial sludge, we might be seeing the first new organism. And that's exciting to me. But
or a mutant.
Right. But I've actually got a question, I think, because I think the big difference between comedy and music, as a comedian, if you go back to the same town or if you're playing to your fans, they like surprise. They'd like you to go back with a different show to the one they saw last time. And it's the exact opposite for music. They might want a couple of new songs, but they'd be really upset if you didn't play the hits. So why does music and comedy hit the brain in different ways? Why do we like surprise with comedy, but familiarity with music?
Interesting enough, within music, expectation is an incredibly important part of music. And what definition of music, going back to the start, could be, you know, stuff that plays with our sense of expectation. So you have a progression of chords, notes going on, and then someone puts in a new note you're not expecting, and your brain goes, wow, that's something really interesting going on.
So that almost is like a punchline, almost like a joke where your brain thinks that the sentence is going one way and then it's suddenly subverted.
And in composition, this is the real key, is, you know, play something really repetitious and something really predictable, it gets very boring. Play something incredibly random, imagine just bashing notes on the piano, you can't tell what's going on, that's also boring. What you need is a bit of randomness, but also a bit of predictability, and that's what makes the best music, is playing on your expectations.
The trend, though, Nitin, if you think about popular music, so you go back to the 1940s, 1950s, you're talking about, you know, the end of jazz, you're talking about Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, quite complicated chord structures, you say quite a lot of surprise. And then it's sort of, in a sense, certainly harmonically de-evolved, hasn't it, into rock and roll, and you end up with, you know, C, F and G and three chords and those things. Do we have any understanding of why that is? Agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with it to some degree, because, I mean, it's complicated, because also there's the tribal thing, isn't it? Because, like, people like different music because they have an association with people that they grew up with or they like, and so they kind of divide into tribes. You know, when I was a kid, it was mods and rockers and blah, blah, blah. But you also get... there's one out there. But there's also the kind of idea of... with consonants and dissonance. So, for example, you know, when you're playing simpler harmonies, then they're more consonant and they're more pleasurable for the brain. From what I've read recently, there's this whole part of your brain that actually is responding differently to dissonance. And like, for example, with a semitone difference or a major seventh difference, they're more dissonant, so you don't feel so much pleasure from them. And there's lots of those kinds of close harmonies with jazz, whereas with rock or pop, it's very different. They're more consonant, so they're easier to digest. And that's the same with animals as well. Apparently that's the same with monkeys. I don't know if you could confirm
what's
that.
What's the same with monkeys? They play less with seventh chords.
No, yeah, with dissonance and consonants, because they have the same, apparently the oscillatory phase lock part of the brain is actually responding, it becomes more active when it's dissonant, so that becomes more uncomfortable for the animal as well.
So are the older monkeys more into dissonance, but the younger monkeys just don't get it?
But there was also that, wasn't there a musical interval that was called the Devil's Interval that was banned?
It was the tritone, and it was back
was
in...
It, yeah, was it an augmented fifth or something
it's
like
a,
that?
It's three tones, and this kind of theory behind it. I mean, a lot of our Western harmony comes from church music. And actually, three tones is really hard to sing together in tune properly. So one of the reasons it may have been banned was just the problems of actually choirs getting it to work properly in churches. But yes, for ages, church would not allow that chord. But now you hear it all over the place. I mean, it wouldn't
but
be a surprise.
It does sound quite evil.
That
yes. It's like it is a dissonant chord and basically sounds like the basis of all heavy metal, pretty much.
But by band, you mean literally it was illegal to play that chord?
Well, they were writing music for the church, so they had to do what the church wanted. So they said, you can't use these chords. And so, and then after a while, obviously, things changed.
Well, what do
so
we
is
know
that why the
you?
Devil had all the best tunes? Because the best tunes had those, you know, Lemmy, you can have that. We're not allowed to have it in St. Michael's, surely would.
But actually, the best tunes have a mixture of dissonance and consonants. So something which is perpetually dissonant is unpleasant. Something which is perpetually consonant, perpetually pleasant, is like nursery rhymes. Again, as an adult, you'd find that boring after a while. So actually, we want to play with tension, which you get from dissonance, and release, which you get from consonants. And that's what all Western music is pretty much about, building tension and releasing it.
It's interesting you say that, Western music, because we're different... harmonies, different scales, different appreciations of different combinations of notes. Do we know much, Nitin, about that?
Yeah, I mean, with flamenco, for example, there's a lot of focus on the minor second, and you use certain scales, like with Indian classical music, it's Rag Bhairavi, which is the same as the Phrygian mode. So you actually have that minor second, which is a dissonant interval, which is quite featured in other cultures. But it quite often, I mean, in film music, for example, with people like Bernard Herrmann with Psycho and films like that, he would actually alternate between dissonance and consonants in order to make people feel on edge and uncomfortable. And with the famous, in fact, with the stabbing in the shower scene, he used a dissonant interval played on high violins in order to get across the squawking of birds in the mind of Norman Bates. So it was kind of so that dissonance can be associated with the way in which we hear sound as well.
So about minor second, you mean like a C and a C sharp,
yeah,
or something
exactly.
like that?
Yeah.
I love the fact that
which is menacing and it's dissonant again.
I've got to say that was usually we talk about quantum cosmology or something, everyone glazes over a bit. I love the fact that you can do that with music as well. Is that going to minor second? You've got to feel the need to explain this.
Brian, when you were writing your hit, did you? I'm interested for the musicians, like, do you get either of you, Nitin, or can you get a sense of when you are writing? So I was thinking of REM had one of their biggest hits ever was Losing My Religion, which I don't think anyone at the time, when it first came on, would have thought, hang on, this thing which opens with a mandolin, it was very kind of where REM were moving, but you wouldn't have thought that was going to be the worldwide hit that everyone was screaming for. Hmm. Is there anything that instinctually you go, now, my judgment, I think I can go, this is going to be a successful song, or are you constantly still surprised? So the science of it can never get to the point of going right from when you're writing from within and not as a factory.
Yeah,
you can't work it.
Well, when you're making music, as Katie was saying, I mean, you don't actually make music for other people. If you start making music for other people, then you're not making something that's expressive or is coming from the heart. You know, you've got to start that way, and then you share it with other people after you've made it, and hopefully they'll like it as well. But
I think if you're talking yourself out of a job writing jingles right now.
Well, it's a different thing. I mean, you know, if you're writing for a specific purpose, I mean, for example, when I was writing music for the Human Planet series, I had to think about the directors, I had to think about the audiences, I had to think about the series producer. If you're writing something for yourself, you're writing some, you know, you're writing it to express your feelings or your thoughts.
Alex, Matt, you know, the jingle thing, the idea that all people are going, should it be, ooh, Danon? No, I think... Ooh, Dan, we're getting there. We have got a yoghurty hit.
Well, Lucy, the other component of music, I suppose, is harmony, and then there's rhythm.
Rhythm, yeah.
Which is important. So what do we know about rhythm, our appreciation of it, where it comes from?
Well, it would seem that there are animals that do appreciate rhythm, actually. So there was a quite recent discovery about a cockatoo that sort of rocks the scientific community by rocking out, actually, on YouTube. There was this cockatoo called Snowball, and it was a video of it dancing to the Backstreet Boys. Everybody, just so everybody knows what the show. So it was, I don't know if anybody's seen it. It got millions of views, and it's really going for it, bobbing its head up and down to the beat and raising its leg, and the scientists was amongst the millions of people that watched this and was like, hang on a second, he really is dancing to that beat. So he got Snowball, the cockatoo, and he took the Backstreet Boys Everybody song and changed the tempo to 11 different versions of Everybody, and then paid it to Snowy to see whether it would still dance and keep the beat. And it did. The cockatoo kept the beat. 25% of the time, actually, the cockatoo kept the beat, which you'd think it would mean that it isn't keeping the beat. But statistically, that is actually significant. So for all of you out there, if you are keeping the beat when you're dancing 25% of the time, statistically, you're a good dancer, which is actually quite good to know. But so then after they'd done that experiment, they were like, this would seem that this cockatoo is responding and does actually have rhythm. They then went onto YouTube and then investigated all the the videos where people are saying that they've got an animal that's dancing, so lots of sort of dogs and cats and all these things, and ruled out all the ones in a very scientific way of which ones they weren't actually dancing, and came down to the fact that there were actually genuine incidences of parrots, cockatoos, and Asian elephants all keeping the beat. And then what's interesting about that is that they're all animals that are very good at vocal mimicry, which we are also very good at. So whether there is some link in the evolution of music that is, or music appreciation that is between the sort of the auditory and the motor skills are somehow linked.
So does that mean,
the weirdest thing about this is, I mean, this is uncanny because I'm actually genuinely totally unrelated to this, working on something to do with Snowball, and I've been watching that video, and I'm doing this thing called Animal Symphony, which is all to do with this. And there's also a sea lion called Ronan, who can bob up and down in time to Boogie Wonderland at different tempos.
Well, they're also very good vocal mimics. Sea lions also have that ability.
But it's the weirdest thing, because literally before I knew you were going to be talking about any of that, it just happens to be something I've been staring at. So what are the chances of... actually, Brian, you could probably tell me what the chances of... Very strange.
Just to be clear then, so when we're meant to be working and instead we're watching funny YouTube animal videos, that's science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what you need is to get the scientific job to go through YouTube finding all the funny videos. But actually, rhythm has a really important purpose to the animal kingdom. Because if you think, let's say you're trying to run away from something that's attacking you, being very rhythmic is incredibly important. You'll run faster. So these animals, it might not just be about vocal. It might be that they have rhythm because it's really important for motor skills.
Sea lions don't run away from things.
Well, what do you know about sea lions?
Actually, this sea lion, it was trained to respond to Boogie Wonderland in that way. But the fact is that no one's sure of what it's responding to, because it could be, and that's what we're trying to figure out at the moment, because in writing this symphony, we're trying to ascertain whether it's about the beats or whether it's about, is it the kick drum itself or is it something else that it's responding to? It's very difficult to know.
So the suggestion, Trevor, then, is that it's to do with the tempo of movement at some level, that there's got to be some irregularity, an appreciation of regularity, as it were.
Well, you get the effect when you put some music on to exercise, don't you? You lock into that beat. You're getting trained to move with that beat. So it's not that surprising maybe that animals can also get entrained to a beat. But I don't know about the sea lions and the swimming. Maybe when they're swimming underwater, they have to be very, very rhythmic in the way they swim to be efficient, because being arrhythmic is an inefficient way of moving.
Katie, are you surprised when you actually, again, looking at the reaction of going back to playing in a big field, you're saying Glastonbury is one of your favourite places to play. Are there certain environments where you go, I feel restricted in what I can do musically, because, sometimes, for instance, it's wonderful to see certain bands in a church. It changes your experience to see that kind of environment. So how do you find the environment, the importance of that?
It's a really fantastic challenge. And I think I also came up busking, and that really changed how I play, because I started off listening to Joni Mitchell and picking on a Spanish guitar, and that's not very useful when you go busking. And so really playing in outdoors and in public places where people aren't actually there to see you, they're walking past, really changed the way that I perform, and it became a very rhythmic way of performing, and I'm a rhythm guitarist, and I'm kind of trying to use the guitar as a drum kit. So for me, it's really enjoyable, even just with a few people in a room playing, because I'll just kind of mutate into that old street player mode.
So what were the tricks? I mean, this is interesting. Is there a point where you'd look down at your hat or your guitar case and think, oh, that's not very full, I better do underneath the bridge?
Yeah, there's
or
a trick.
Everybody hurts. This, oh, that's filled yeah. it up.
Is there, I mean, never, or... never busk in Dundee. That's one of the tricks. Not worth it. I, unfortunately for busking, I'm really, really bad at remembering lyrics. So I'd struggle to remember my own, never mind remembering covers. So I never really was able to do that many covers, but it was a good way of working out which songs of my own worked. But usually it was the very rhythmic ones and the very repetitive ones that people can latch onto.
I was going to say, is there anything also just about a festival like Glastonbury when you're talking about the communal nature of music, that just the general grime and adversity and that feeling that we're all in this together, that
the great leveler.
It does kind of add a sort of communal atmosphere. The idea that by Sunday we're all just the same dregs of humanity, stinking messes, but at the same time that sort of overcomes that barrier of that individuality.
It's also being outside. I think there's something that's very elevated about the experience of very loud sound, and it's outdoors, so it's out with our usual experience. It's quite exotic even. But definitely that experience of being in nature and being in the elements and feeling sensations of wind and bad breath and whatever comes your way. It's a very sensory experience that's kind of amplified.
There is something wonderful about it, everyone will experience this in a tent, that you were acclimatized to Glastonbury really quickly.
Yeah.
And then you get, stop off on your first Little Chef on the way back, and you look in a mirror and you go, oh my God! What was I doing? What do I put on my face? It's indelible!
I think that there's like a feral switch. It's like a Neanderthal feral switch that kind of just gets switched as soon as you get out of your car and you're out, and then you're a changed person for a few days.
I also want to know from our physicist here how a tent can be colder than outdoors at night, and then a second after dawn, it's the hottest that's ever been recorded.
Thermodynamics. The wonders of thermodynamics. My next series.
We were going to also deal with, we won't get time today, why is Bohemian Rhapsody constantly voted number one as people's favourite song?
Well, we could have a 1 second answer, or five second answer.
Does anyone
why
know?
Is it?
What is it? Any theory of what it is about either Stairway to Heaven or Bohemian Rhapsody? They are always jockeying for position.
I mean, Bohemian Rhapsody, it's about six different songs. So you're hitting you're kind of hitting different genres of music in that song. So there's a bit, everyone's got a different favourite bit.
I blame Wayne's World.
Which returns us to the cockatoo movement that Lucy showed only a short time earlier. So that brings an end to, because we've run out of time. So that's what we've got time for. Next week we're treading mugged back through the BBC Radio Theatre in London. But now can we say thanks to our supergroup for today, who have been Lucy Cook, Trevor Cox, Matt Kirshen, Katie Tunstall and Nitin Sawhney. I can also say that if you are hanging around the festival, Brian is going to spend the rest of the weekend unicycling down ley lines to increase his energy. Then he's going to wake up in the nettles on Monday with a box that Noel Edmonds sold him. So thank you very much for being such a delightful crowd.
Thank you very much.
In the infinite monkey cage.
Without your trousers.
In the infinite monkey cage.
Isn't that nice again?
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox.
Throughout our 14 series, we've always tried to be at the forefront of scientific revolutions and also contentious theories. And today is no different. For centuries, it's been commonly believed that the structure of little girls is primarily sugar, spice and all things nice, while boys are predominantly genetically made of slugs, snails and puppy dog tails. But the latest research from Norway is suggesting something very different. So
it's not far wrong, actually. Because we're all made of the same ingredients, they get recycled a lot. So there's a high probability that the protons or carbon atoms in a puppy dog's tail would have got recycled when you buried it in the garden before you were born, and then it grew into some asparagus plant or something. And then
Can I stop you there? When you buried it in the garden before you were born, yet again, a physicist who goes, of course, the nature of time is very malleable. So tonight we are going to be talking about, well, there's antimony, arsenic, aluminium, selenium, and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, and ruthenium, and uranium. And there's others too, aren't there, Brian?
Lanthanum and osmium and astatine and radium and gold, protostenium, indium and gallium and
iodine. And iodine and thorium, thulium and thallium. So we don't have time for that, so what are we going to do, Brian?
Well, we're going to look at what you need to build a universe. What are the ingredients and how are they put together?
And so, to join us, we have a panel, and that panel is...
Professor Andreas Heiler from UCL. I'm a chemist, and if I were building a universe, I would make it out of mercury, because that way it would be beautiful.
I'm Lucy Green. I'm a professor of physics at UCL. And if I was building a universe and I could use only one element, I would use helium, because then you have everything you need to make stars and party balloons.
I'm Rufus Hound. I'm the professor of nothing anywhere. And if I was making a universe out of only one element, I'd use iron, because then I would be Iron Man. Although, disappointingly, I'd be married to the Iron Lady, and I just don't like those politics.
And this is our panel!
Okay, so we'll start with you. We're going to start with a definition. So, how would you define an element? What do we mean by the elements of the periodic table?
I think the best way to define elements is really by analogy. If you think about going into a library and thinking about all of the possible books and encyclopedias and so on, they are made up of fundamental units, and you can work your way down from paragraphs to sentences to letters. And eventually what you've got are, in English, 26 building blocks, right? The letters of the alphabet. And so the elements are really the fundamental, well, now 118-ish, units, sort of ideas, elements that you make up the whole world from.
Ish,
because, yeah, I mean, actually naturally occurring, there's only about 90 or thereabouts. We've found more of those, but they're so short-lived that they don't really count.
And the building blocks of those elements are?
The building blocks of those elements, of course, you know, we can go down to protons, neutrons, electrons. You can go down beyond to things that you know how to spell, like quarks. So, yes, what you're trying to get me to say is that, of course, it's all down to physics.
I think we should bring... Speaking of which, Professor Lucy... we should start, actually, because we're mainly talking about chemistry, so we're going to talk about the chemical elements, how they're built, how they work together. But we should just do justice to the fact that they're made out of smaller building blocks, the quarks. So they were made in the first minute or so of the universe. So we thought we'd just give you 1 minute, which is the time it took the universe to build the primordial elements, to explain how those elements were built in the first minute of the universe.
Okay,
starting
that's
now.
Nice. So... the idea around the Big Bang is that you have this phenomenal explosion where out of apparently nothing, space and time begins. I mean, okay, we could discuss what's beforehand, but we don't have time. But in that process of formation of the universe...
it was 10 to the minus 36 seconds for the universe.
Yes, we had the formation of quarks and also electrons. But in the conditions... early on, they were so hot, they don't immediately come together, but very soon the particles do start to come together, so you start to form protons and neutrons and electrons. And then eventually, after several minutes, you can have your protons and neutrons starting to come together. So I've probably done that in less than a minute. I'm probably faster than actually the formation of the universe.
So you're saying you're better than the universe?
Yes, actually, I think I am.
What impressed me was that three people laughed when you said, I'd like to have to say what talked about before the Big Bang, what happened then, but we haven't got time. And then they went, oh, because we didn't have time then. And the rest of them missed that particular joke. So well done, three of you. You're our core demographic, which doesn't bode well for the future of the series.
So we've got about, after a minute or so, we've got the two or three simplest elements, basically. We've got hydrogen. Single proton, helium, two protons, two neutrons, a bit of lithium.
That's right, so a small amount of lithium. And what's really interesting is that, yeah, that those processes that happened in the early universe set up everything we have today. So that the universe by mass is mostly hydrogen, and then you have around 25% helium. A little bit of lithium, like you say, was formed, but nothing else. So very, very primitive building blocks of the universe.
Could you just... so we can picture this. So we're talking about the periodic table of the elements. It's your turn for the 1 minute summary. So the 1 minute radio picture of the periodic table.
So the periodic table really consists, I would say, if you wanted to picture it in your head, of three main sort of rectangles. There's one on the left-hand side with which are the elements that I think most children of all ages want to get their hands on. Those are the things that you want to throw into water and blow up, the alkali metals, that sort of stuff. I brought one. That's the cesium over here.
Can you? Are you going to throw it into your water?
I could throw it into the wine glass here. It'd be rather expensive, and the program would end. So maybe we'll do that after the microphones go off.
Trust you used me, to I'm a demonstrate chemist. At the Science Museum. That was one of your jobs, wasn't it, Rufus?
Yes.
Did you used to do these kind of experiments? Because it's what all kids want to when they get into chemistry. You want to see the bangs and flashes.
Yeah, although not as much as you might... Well, I say as much as you might like, as much as I might have liked. We blew up quite a lot of hydrogen because it's cheap.
Are we supposed to issue some kind of disclaimer at this point? So, because this is broadcast on the school run. That's the problem.
Yeah. Oh, no, but there is, I think, a genuine argument that science isn't dangerous enough at school. It's true.
I would agree.
You can laugh, but the thing that makes chemists want to be chemists is that at school they saw a grown-up blow something up. And they went, oh, I need in on this. And now everything's so health and safety that, you know, you get to a science lesson and, you know, you're not allowed to even look at a thermometer without wearing goggles and a welder's mask. And it just feels like, oh, yeah, it's just more of this. It's all theory.
It's the same with biology, isn't it? It's all very well looking at the insides of a frog in a line drawing, but finding them in your pocket placed there by some other awful boy really is a far greater education, isn't it?
Yes, I would imagine so. But that would fall under the auspices of the Natural History Museum, not the Science Museum, and therefore I don't care.
Oh, OK, great.
Andrea, perhaps you just... Could you describe the structure of the elements, the structure of the atoms, and why, what it is that you look for as a chemist, how you describe such a reaction? That, let's say you drop the cesium into the water. What's happening?
Well, the key thing about chemistry is that chemistry is all about the electrons. In fact, all about the outermost electrons. And you can think of an atom, in a sense, as having this very, very hard kernel in the center, the positively charged nucleus. You then have these diffuse layers, onion-like, of electrons around the outside. And it's the outermost ones which are the ones which really are involved in doing the chemistry. So sometimes, I mean, it worries me that people say, oh, you know, it's not possible that life could have sort of emerged spontaneously, because we keep being told about this particle theory of matter, that there are all these dancing particles doing random things. And chemistry is very far from random. I mean, the moment you bring a carbon up to an oxygen, for example, and you link them together, then suddenly the way the electrons are distributed is very unsymmetrical. So the oxygens are negative, the carbon is positive. And suddenly now, if you have two of those together, they will come together, you know, repelling and attracting each other in particular ways. And so the outcomes become in some ways predictable, but also much more interesting. And you can start building stuff. And, you know, amongst the things that you might build, and this really demonstrates, I think, the superiority of chemistry over physics, is this stuff, right? Is that you can take those building blocks, and you can make fart goo. Well, I mean, come on.
That is actually the sound effect they use on the Archers when they have that Incontinent Cows episode, isn't it? That is, you are in charge of the fart goo.
The very one, yes.
So this is, just because there is going to be a change apparently in terms of in school education, where there's going to be the actual practical side, the blowing stuff up, the making fart goo. How important was it for you when you were actually first learning about chemistry to be able to get, well, properly get your hands, you know, both dirty and blistered?
Well... I was never really into the explosives nutter side of things. But one of the things that really got me into chemistry was a teacher who, when I was supposed to do a practical where you had to identify what was in the tube, said to me, have a sniff and you'll know what it is. And he opened up a whole kind of universe of things. And then I sort of went beyond that and I thought, well, what do they taste like? So, first of all, I decided that I would taste the acids in the lab. And that's when I realized that what chemists call dilute acid is 0.1 molar. in the mouth that's not diluted. My teeth were rubby for weeks after that. But they all tasted very distinctive. So then I moved on to the salt.
Lucy, how are you alive? Because there is, every time that I see you do any demonstrations, there's definitely a bit where the people at the back go, he didn't put that on the health and safety form. And but the idea of just tasting those things, that level of adventure, and we should say, genuinely, that we've never had to say this on the show in 14 series, don't do anything, Andrea says, that we've never said about, I mean, literally anything. Oh. Some of it may sound innocuous, except, but I imagine there is still a chance that you will either kill yourself or your puppy.
Or you will develop a lifelong fascination with science, so maybe you should.
But that's the point.
But a lot of them won't. Now, I know you're looking from a Darwinian perspective here.
No.
Some of them will be strong enough to survive as chemists, but most of the potential chemists will die.
But isn't that, I think, is why chemistry is the funnest of the sciences, even if it's not the purest or whatever else, is that chemistry's history is of people who went, I wonder what that is. Give it a sniff. Bite a chunk off it. Like, the reason Marie Curie died of what she died of when she died was they were like, I wonder what radioactivity is. Bring loads of that ash here and just stir it up in a big pot. No idea what it was at all. And the early descriptions of all the different elements do include smell and taste. That's how you knew what you were getting. So
yeah, but Marie Curie didn't lick the radium. She had a rule. If it glows, make her husband lick it.
But I would bet a pound to a penny at some point Marie Curie went, I wonder what it tastes like. Because they just lived in a time before the knock-on effects of that were, you know, particularly considered. Mercury, which now, if a thermometer breaks, you have to evacuate a whole school and, like, you know, warning sirens go off. I was at school and you used to be able to play with it in your hands and poke around with it. It's like...
But I think the early aspects of all kinds of science were about human experimentation. We always started on ourselves, whether it was physics, chemistry or biology. And I can think of experiments that were done even in the mid-1900s where, following the Apollo astronauts' flights, where they had flashes of lights in their eyes, even when they closed their eyes in the darkness, they saw these bright flashes. And they wanted to investigate what was causing them, so they surmised that it was high-energy particles moving through the retina. And to test this on the ground, they set up beams of high-energy particles, and people stuck their heads in front of them.
Yeah. We were talking about this.
Lager, shouting.
I want to... we should just investigate...
I want to deviate back onto the subject.
The history, we want to talk about the history, but first I thought we've talked about the origin of the chemical elements, the first three or four lightest elements in the Big Bang. So, Lisa, you're a solar physicist, so you deal with the way that stars shine, which is by producing heavier elements. So could you outline what's happening in the sun and how stars build those elements and construct them?
So perhaps one thing to raise is that temperature is important. So actually when we talked about the Big Bang, the fact that cooling happens means you start to be able to bring particles together and they stay together. So they don't have enough energy to separate away from themselves. Energy and temperature are the same thing. And when it comes to understanding stars, you're right, we want to know how stars shine, and that was really the origin of starting to understand how elements are formed. And I think that the most important process is the one that takes the nuclei of hydrogen and turns it into the nuclei of helium. So this is the basic process that is powering most of the stars that we see in the night sky. So stars live out most of their lives on something called the main sequence, and during that time you're bringing together protons, which are the nuclei of hydrogen, and turning them into the nuclei of helium. And actually, it's a really interesting process that the particles go through, because it's not just a case of just bringing them together and oof, they stick. You've got to have the right energies. And in fact, more than that, you have to bring in quantum mechanical effects, because actually the energies inside of stars aren't quite enough for this process to happen. So it is a fairly rare process. But overall, step by step, you can take protons, you can bring them together to make what's known as deuterium. You get some other particles and energies come out in the forms of neutrinos or perhaps gamma rays later on. Then you bring together these deuteriums, you bring in another proton, and you start step by step to build up towards a nucleus, which is then two protons and two neutrons, and that's your helium nucleus. And that's the fundamental process that's happening across the universe.
Andrew, we've talked about, we've mentioned the history of chemistry, the history of science quite a lot, but we go back to the periodic table. So what's the first element that was identified, and how did we begin to say these are things, there's hydrogen and helium and lithium, and you can do your little song now again.
Well, the idea of elements had always been around, and that there had to be somehow or other building blocks out of which the world was composed. But it's really in the 18th century that you start to be able to classify things, and that there are things which cannot be reduced chemically to anything simpler. And so gradually you start to codify this idea that there is a carbon, there is a sodium, you know, then eventually, you know, more and more of these unique components are discovered. And through the 19th century you get this incredible race. And that race is to find more and more elements. That's how you can become famous.
Please, can we talk about Dmitri Mendeleev?
We are going to be talking about Dmitri Mendeleev. Oh. So now, because Rufus is very excited about the periodic table, and it's kind of, and that is, Dmitri Mendeleev is this thing. So can we go through just that, a bit of that story? So can you give us a little bit of that, the mystery and that kind of adventure that he went on as he created the periodic table?
Yeah, in the 19th century, I mean, one of the things that had started to strike people was the fact that there were similarities between certain elements. And in particular, that they went in threes. That was the original was a law of triads, that there were three elements that went together. Now, in fact, the guy who came up with this was a Freemason, and it's possible that the periodic table, at its heart, the original idea was a Masonic conspiracy. But leaving that aside,
we can't leave that aside completely, can we?
There are reasons we must. I recommend reading Alan Moore's From Hell. Anyway.
By the time you get to Mendeleev, there are actually so many elements there, right, that the pattern is now getting sort of, you know, you now have sort of five elements that you can put, that you can associate. And Mendeleev essentially assembled this without really knowing what the rules were. The only thing that he knew was that things were going to get heavier as you sort of went down, but that then you could group things according to properties. And the astonishing thing is that actually, you know, he became so confident in his scheme that A, he was able to leave placeholders for things that he thought must be there but weren't. And then in one crucial place at the bottom of the periodic table, he spotted that iodine and tellurium, that their masses were the wrong way around, but he put iodine under the halogens, under chlorine and bromine, and he put tellurium under sulfur and selenium because it was more chemically right.
Can I, from a layman's point of view, point out why that is so cool? Is that Mendeleev was a scientist in the old-fashioned sense of wanting to know more, and travelled around Russia on the trains that were fresh, and didn't spend his time in the first-class carriages, but spent them hanging out with the farmers and pointing out why the chemical nature of the soil would lead to better crops for them. So it was like a really early front-runner in science communication and the practical applications of the things of the great wisdom and the knowledge that was spilling out at that time. So there was that that made him a kind of a renegade figure. But the other thing was that when he found these lists of elements, or when he spotted that the properties put them in shared groups, he left these two gaps. But what is just so amazing is that at the time, there was, as sort of exists now, a sense that, but we already know what all of the stuff is. And therefore, if you've left two gaps, your theory is wrong. And Mendeleev went, what if we don't? And they went, but we do. And he went, but what if we don't? And within 2 years, two elements were discovered. One of them, gallium, named after Gaul, or the French word for cockerel, which was Gallic, which was the thing of naming.
But there's more to it, because the guy who discovered it, his surname was Lecoq.
Yes.
Which means the cockerel, the rooster. So he managed, and he was hounded about this, to get his own name in the pun, plus the country he was from, right, all into one element.
So to present a theory with gaps that then allow other scientists to step up and go, oh, hang on, maybe they're... Like, if you don't present the whole thing as the finished piece and then have your competitors almost validate your theory, that's as good as science gets. To have confidence in your idea
and then allow for the ego wrought posturing of your contemporaries to then force them to actually chime with truth rather than ego. That's as good as humanity gets, quite outside of science and whatnot. But I just like this idea that there's this hairy old bloke travelling around on trains talking to farmers who forces the building blocks of the universe to be understood in a superior fashion.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Jay, we talked about the, Lucy talked about the building of the lighter element. So you talked about hydrogen to helium and then carbon and oxygen. But when you get to element 26, so you get to iron, no longer are those built in the simple way in stars. So we've got a lot of elements beyond that. So could you just outline how those come into being? So we're talking about common ones, gold, silver, tin.
You're right. When you go beyond iron, you're looking at processes then that build up the structure, but that require energy to be put in. So everything up to iron or thereabouts, you can release energy. And that's the wonderful thing about the processes, because that's how you power stars. You bring hydrogen nuclei together and you release energy, and that powers our sun and many other stars out there. But once you go beyond iron, the situation changes. So then you have to think, well, how can you start to build up larger structures, which essentially is revolving around bringing in more neutrons and capturing them into the nucleus of the particles. And you can do that in stars. If you have a source of neutrons along with a process that allows you to transform a neutron into a proton. So if you remember, the nucleus contains protons and neutrons together. You can't just keep building in more and more neutrons. You'd build a very unstable particle, but you can transform some of those neutrons into protons and build bigger nuclei. So stars could do this if they have some neutrons available, but when it really happens in a dramatic way, you see these elements being formed during a supernova explosion. Then you have a flood of neutrons and you have neutrinos rushing through as well. And in those processes, you can build the larger elements, which are absolutely important for us.
Noble gases, WTF, right? they basically don't react. They don't do, you like...
Oh, yes, they do.
So, hang on then. Okay, right.
Yeah.
Helium...
Helium doesn't, I agree.
Okay, but...
So we have a final question for all three of you, which is, if you could create an element that would be a real boon for the universe but doesn't exist as yet, what are we missing?
I don't want one element. I want a whole periodic table of dark matter. Just think, a whole new universe of chemistry. Dark chemistry.
Surely, obviously, the one we all want. Boom! It's the element of surprise.
What do you reckon, Lucy?
So, what's missing? What's missing? Well, I like the dark universe, the dark periodic table, but maybe one of the big questions is why we don't have enough antimatter in the universe, so maybe I would like to see the antimatter periodic table. Why is it that we have so much matter and not enough antimatter? Where's it gone?
So we asked our audience, if you'd remove one element from the periodic table, what would it be and why? And these were the answers. Aluminium, to save Americans from pronouncing it wrong.
The fifth element, because Bruce Willis never improved on his role in Die Hard.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Whoa, whoa.
Objection hound.
The fifth element is Willis's final hour. Lilu, Mia Jovovich wearing nothing but Versace. Get over yourself. Who wrote that?
It was Dan Benton.
Car park, Dan, car park.
This one is, it says EU, Europium, 63, because it costs us £350 million a week. And it's signed Nigel Farage.
Rhenium, because things can only get better by derenium.
Oh, you can't get better than that.
You can't be.
Thank you very much to our panel, Andrea Sella, Lucy Green and Rufus Hound. While we've been off air, we've had lots of questions, and the one we've picked out the hat today is from Mark Saunders, and he emailed us with this. Due to relativity and time dilation, is it possible that somewhere in the universe a star is born and dies in our lifetime? Brian?
It's a good question. You've got to try and get into a position where time speeds up for you relative to the star, because stars last. What are the shortest-lived stars, Lucy? Quite,
I think a few millions of years.
Yeah, so some of them are quite quick. So you've got to speed time up. So I think you'd have to go close to a massive object. In fact, we did this, didn't we, Rufus, in the Science of Doctor Who. You put a little rucksack on for some reason and then pretended and acted falling into a black hole.
Teetered on the brink of a black hole.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you could teeter around close to a black hole or fall into one, then you would see the whole history of the universe actually play out as you fell across the event horizon. So I would say to go stand close to a black hole.
Do we need to bring that another warning? Please do not go and stand close to a black hole. May well affect your length. So, thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
Turn out nice again.
Hello and welcome to the Infinite Monkey Cage. I'm Brian Cox.
And I'm Robert Ince. And I should say that we're trying to be proactive with this show and make shows that react to our audience's scientific questions, such as, why does Saturn have rings? What is consciousness? And I had a lovely dream about Brian Cox last night. What does it mean? Annoyingly, because of lazy science, we don't have answers to the first two questions. Therefore, tonight's show is about, what does it mean to have a lovely dream about Brian Cox? Well, it's also about sleep, but sleep and having lovely dreams about Brian Cox.
Why do animals need sleep? What are the ramifications of not sleeping? How can we improve our sleep? And what is the purpose of dreaming?
For instance, this is the sound of Brian's dreams.
And this is the sound of Robin's dreams.
I don't sleep much. So, in fact, one of the main reasons we're doing this show is because I do actually have insomnia a lot of the time. And though I didn't until I started working with Brian, which makes me believe that Brian is actually stealing my sleep to keep his boyish replicant good looks.
To aid us in our exploration of sleep, dreams and circadian rhythms, we are joined by a panel of the wise, and they are...
Russell Foster, I'm Professor of Circadian Neuroscience at the University of Oxford. And my worst night of sleep is very recent. I was in Denver, Colorado, a week ago, and I was jet-lagged, and the next morning I had to speak to 3,500 delegates at the sleep meeting, and I had the most appalling night's sleep for years.
Richard Wiseman, Professor of Psychology at University of Hertfordshire. I'm a psychologist, and my worst night's sleep was when I was developing a smartphone sleep app, and I was beta-testing it. The programming was off, and so the alarm went off at 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and 6 a.m., which was delightful.
My name's Katie Brand. I am a comedian and writer, and my worst night of sleep was my 19-hour labour, followed by my second worst night of sleep, which was spent just staring at the clock going, it's a baby.
And this is our panel.
So, Russell, the first question must be, why do we sleep?
I think the scientific community has been a bit naughty about that one, because you read these endless papers of the reason we sleep, and there is no single overarching explanation for sleep. What happens during this period of immobility is a whole mass of stuff. So there's memory consolidation, there's the processing of information, there's the clearance of toxins, there's the rebuilding of metabolic pathways. You know, you name it, so much of the important stuff that makes us function during the daytime is going on whilst we're asleep. So there's multiple reasons why we sleep and what's going on in the brain during this period of physical inactivity.
So sort of housekeeping.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. There's a bunch of essential housekeeping functions. And during evolution, what's happened is that those essential sort of housekeeping functions have been allocated to the appropriate phase of the rest activity cycle. And that's what we call sleep.
So, Richard, what is the, for a human being, what's the sleep cycle now? What stages do we go through?
Well, again, we're not 100% certain. The generally accepted sleep cycle is we start off in what's called light sleep, which is if you have a nap in the afternoon, that feels a lot like light sleep. Then we move down into deep sleep, and if you were to wake up from deep sleep, you really wouldn't feel very well for quite a long way. You might vomit over the person you're sleeping next to, and then they wouldn't feel very well. So we have light sleep, we have deep sleep, then you come up from there into almost wakefulness and you have the first dream of the night. And that dream will last around about 5 minutes. So you have light sleep, deep sleep, up into what's called REM or dream state, roughly. I mean, not all dreaming is in REM and so on, but roughly speaking. And that's the sleep cycle. It lasts about 90 minutes. You go through it again and again, with the periods of dreaming getting longer and longer. And so the last dream before you wake up is around about 45 minutes, 30, 45 minutes long, something like that.
Can you explain why some people are morning people? It disgusts me.
I could explain that, but I wouldn't want